Scripture reading this morning will be taken from the first two verses of Ephesians chapter 5. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God.
I entitled our lesson this morning, Pupils of Christ. And in reality, I think I probably need to give credit for that title to one of my students a year ago. I was teaching beginning Greek, and for the first time ever, I had a student from Greece in the class. She was learning Koine Greek, New Testament Greek, but she spoke Greek fluently. She grew up speaking Greek, and she was very fluent in English as well. We came across this word that my students learned as disciples. But every time we would get the word, and I would ask the students to define the word, she would define it as pupils or students. Right. No, that is right. That's exactly what the word means. To be a disciple of Jesus means to be indeed his student. And so that, I think, is important for us. A man went to a new car salesman and he said, "What's new about this year's model?" And the man said, "Well, the cigarette lighter is 1 inch closer to the steering wheel than it was last year. Not much change." Interestingly enough, with the recent car that we bought, the change was huge. The difference was significant. It was a huge difference. And really, in this our text for this morning, Paul is calling for the Christians in Ephesus to have a real change in their life because Jesus is their teacher. And it's really about getting to know him and what he's all about. We begin in verse 17. "Now, this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds." It's time that you change, and the change needs to be significant for you folks. Many of the folks in his audience were Gentiles. They weren't Jews who'd become Christians, but rather were Gentiles. And he begins by saying that their way of life had been futile. It's the futility of their way. It's a word for emptiness. They had a pointless walk. You see, when you're not a Christian, you're walking, but your pathway of life is really kind of meaningless. And that's exactly what he's going to say in the text. He will continue, "They are darkened in their understanding, alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to their hardness of heart. They have become callous and have given themselves up to sensuality and greed to practice every kind of impurity." He now goes on to talk about this former lifestyle that they have. He begins by saying they have been darkened. It's a dark life that they live. They've been intellectually blacked out because they don't know what really matters. They have a flawed sense of reality. They've been separated from the life of God, and this broken life is significant. It occurs because of the ignorance that is in them. They don't know God. And because they don't know God, they don't know how they ought to live. They need to know God. It's also because of the hardening of their hearts. That word for hardening there is an interesting word. It's the word we get marble from. They have a heart that is so hard that it just doesn't reason with them. They are calloused. They don't feel the pain of sin anymore. It's really a pointless life. It's a broken life, a pointless, flawed sense of reality. Their relationship with God has been broken. He goes on to describe that with several interesting words. They've become callous. They've given up to sensuality. That's kind of sexual immorality. They do whatever they want to do. They have been greedy. What they want, they're going to get at all costs. And they practice all kinds of impurity. That's the way their life was. But that should have ceased. Those lives are unsatisfying lives. Their life before they became Christians was really pretty empty. Some of you may have lived that kind of life before you became a Christian as well. And you see how empty that kind of life is. Once you come to know Jesus, all of that ought to change because you know him. And that's where our word that I translated pupils is going to come about. That is not the way you learned Christ. That word for learned there is the word we get disciple from. You've been discipled into Christ. You've been his students. Because you are students or pupils of Christ, assuming that you have heard about Him and were taught in Him as the truth is in Jesus. You folks have learned Jesus. You are His disciples. And it's an interesting word again. It's that word that my student translated student, pupil. You are His pupils. And because you are His pupils, that's the case. The next phrase, assuming that, is literally, if indeed you have. He's assuming they've learned this. Assuming that you have heard about Jesus, you've heard the story of Jesus, you know who He is and what He's all about, because the truth is in Jesus. And assuming that you've heard this, all of that should make a difference. They have been taught in Jesus. Jews make a big deal of being learned in the Torah. They've learned the law. But Christians have learned the Messiah. We've learned Jesus and who He is and what He's done. And all of that should make a difference. I assume that you have heard about Him. And so He makes a big deal of this. He continues to put off the old self, which belongs to your former manner of life, and is corrupt through the deceitful desires, and to be renewed in the spirit of your minds, to put on the new self created after the likeness of God in the true righteousness and holiness. A lot of folks who are scholars in the Bible contend that what he's talking about here is something that happens at baptism. Interestingly enough, in the olden days, as folks were going to be baptized, they would go into the water wearing their old clothes, and when they would come up out of the water, they put a nice white robe on them. So they had this new white robe. And so he uses this disrobing and robing language here to talk about their former life. And he says, just like you take off the old dirty garment that you used to wear, you're going to put on a new one. And so your former life, which was corrupt and it has all these deceitful desires, you are now renewed in the spirit of your minds. You think differently. As Christians, we ought to think differently. Our perspective should be different. Everything is different for us because in Him we have found what matters. We are created in the likeness of God. We are, as we become new Christians and as you come out of the water of baptism, there's something about you that's like God. Your perspectives should be God perspectives. It's a different way of living, a different way of thinking. Everything should change because you've put on this new self and there is this true righteousness and holiness. It's at that point, he says, because you've been taught in Him, I want you to understand something about what the pupil's life is. It is that disrobing. And then he's going to argue that there are certain things that are going to be practical injunctions that will grow from that. The first thing is, he says, therefore, put away falsehood. Let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. The first admonition is this, stop lying. Isn't that strange? That you have to tell Christians to stop lying? But that, again, has been part of their lifestyle, their former pagan lifestyle. And they need to tell the truth and be people of the truth. They've got to stop their lying. Put aside falsehood and speak the truth with your neighbor. Here, undoubtedly, he's talking about neighbors as fellow Christians in particular, because he goes on to say, we are members of one another. We are, as a church, a community. And being that community should make all of the difference. And we've got to be truthful to our brothers and sisters. We can't lie to them. That's just inappropriate. And then he goes on to say that you need to stop being angry like you were. He says, be angry, but do not sin. Notice he says be angry because he assumes everybody's going to have a little anger every once in a while. Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger. Give no opportunity to the devil. I can remember well my parents telling my brothers and I when we would go to bed at night, if we'd had a little squabble that night, you know, they would say, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. And they were basically saying, stop that fighting and you guys need to kind of make up. And that kind of language is good language. I've heard folks who are marriage counselors say that that's something they advise the husbands and wives when they come to them and are having marital problems. They will say to them, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. Before you go to bed, don't go to bed mad. You've got to work through those kind of issues beforehand. And here he's saying that that's something that all Christians should do. Because if you don't, you give the devil a spot. He's got a place to get you. He can cause you to stumble in all sorts of ways. You've got to stop that kind of nonsense. And then, interestingly enough, he's going to say, stop stealing. Let the thief no longer steal, but rather let him labor, doing honest work with his own hands so that he may have something to share with anyone who's in need. It seems strange to have to tell folks to stop stealing, doesn't it? Folks who are Christians shouldn't be stealers. It's interesting enough that especially among slaves, stealing was kind of the norm. They basically say, I'm a slave, and I don't get paid for what I do, so I take something from my master, it's no big deal. And that, again, is something he's going to argue is wrong. You may remember good old Onesimus, the runaway slave that we read about in the book of Philemon. Paul will say, now if he took anything, I'll pay it back. I won't tell you, by the way, that you owe your life to me, but anyway, I'll pay it back if he's taken anything. Because it was assumed that as a runaway slave, he would probably steal. It's interesting that stealing, again, has become a kind of norm in many cultures around us. I spent one summer working at a Heister company, a factory, where they make forklift trucks. They don't make them here in the States anymore. They're all made down in Mexico now. But I worked one summer there, and there was a fellow there who boasted to us, I have a forklift truck in my basement right now that I built from pieces that I took home one at a time from the company. He basically stole all the parts to put together a whole lift truck and put them in his basement. Stealing, though, shouldn't be the norm for us. That's not who we are. He goes on to say that you need to labor. And the word for labor there is work hard. You got to work hard. Again, there's one of the things that a lot of folks who are hiring people like to hire Christians because they're hard workers. They put their heart into what they're doing. Work hard. Do honest work with your own hands so that you'll have something to share. It's not so that you'll have something to hoard away, but so that you'll have something to share with those who are in need. Isn't that interesting? It's the call for Christians to be sharers. There's nothing wrong with being rich, but if you're rich, you need to share what you've got. And so the call is for them to indeed be sharers. He moves from those things, and it's really interesting with all of those admonitions, to one more about evil talk. Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up, as fits the occasion, as it may give grace to those who hear. And basically, he's now saying, stop that evil talk. He's really here commending what is rotten in terms of language. It's the kind of language that Christians ought not have. It could be anything from obscenity to abusive language to malicious talk. It's any of that. Instead of that, you need to say things that are going to build others up, that will encourage them to live the Christian life, that will encourage them to be God's people, so that it will give grace to those who hear. You need to have a kind of language that is gracious. It's grace-filled, and it helps others to see the grace again. He argues that, indeed, if you're a disciple of Jesus, a pupil of Jesus, those are things that you should have learned, because you learned those in Him. And if you don't do that, he says, you're going to grieve the Spirit. Don't grieve the Holy Spirit of God by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. It's really interesting. When he says here, don't grieve the Spirit, it's not that they're doing something in offense that's aimed at the Spirit. You know, you're just trying to do something bad to the Spirit. But basically he's saying, because you're hurting the community, that's an offense to God. When you hurt the community, you are offending God. And that's important for us. There are folks who are gossips. And being a gossip and telling all of those kind of terrible tales can be hurtsome to the kingdom. And if it's hurtsome to the kingdom, it is grieving the Spirit. You get the same kind of language in Acts 7 where it talks about resisting the Spirit or in 1 Thessalonians 5, where it's quenching the Spirit. You see, the Spirit's been put at work in you, but the Spirit who's at work in you is going to be grieved and hurt if you are doing those kind of things I've just called you not to do. And so you shouldn't do that. It is by Him you have been sealed. I like the language. Sealing something back then was to guarantee its purity. You would seal an envelope. You put a piece of wax on it, you put a stamp on it, and that says it's real. And if the wax has been broken, somebody got into it. It's not genuine anymore. And here He says, you have been sealed for the day of redemption. God's put His stamp of approval on you for His second coming and the day of redemption. At the very end of time, you've got His stamp on you. Interesting language, isn't it? And again, we have been approved by God, and something wonderful is at work here. They can quench the Spirit of God with bitterness and rage and anger and shouting and slander, but kindness and compassion should be their way. He goes on to say, but let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander be put away from you, along with all malice. Those are the kind of things that will indeed grieve the Spirit. It will hurt God's Spirit. It will hurt God if you're doing this to your brothers and sisters. And so that's something that you've got to put away. And so it should go by the wayside. He's been using this wonderful metaphor as we work our way through the text of walking. He goes on to say the positive things, but be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another as God in Christ forgave you. See, that's the opposite of that bitterness and rage and anger and shouting and slander. Now He gives us the virtues that we should have instead. Being compassionate, kind and compassionate. Tender-hearted is the word. Literally, it's well-intestined, because they would say you feel for somebody in your belly. And so you should have this tender compassion for others and forgive one another, because Christ forgave us and we must be called to be like Him. We're going to come back to that walk metaphor in the last part of our text for this morning. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children. Imitate Him as His children. And walk in love just as Christ loved us and gave Himself up for us, a fragrant offering and a sacrifice for sin. We began chapter 4 several weeks ago, and as we were beginning chapter 4, you'll remember He used that phrase, walk in a manner worthy of your calling. Walk in a manner worthy of your calling. And now He's just said, you need to no longer walk as the Gentiles. And so now to close it all out, He comes back to that walk language again. Walk in love. I like the word for love here. It's the word agape, and you've heard preachers talk about agape a lot. Agape is an interesting word. It's not a word that is like our word love. We talk about it as something that you can kind of fall in love and fall out of love and all of those kind of... It's not that kind of love at all. In fact, the word love is a word that has to do with priorities, putting first. You got to put people first. Walk in love. Walk in a way, live in a way that puts people first, people's needs first. And so He emphasizes that whole kind of idea. He's going to use that very same word in just a bit later in the next chapter, when He will call husbands to love their wives. It's not like them. You better like your wife. You should really like her. You wouldn't have married her. You should like her, but it's not like her. And it's not be emotionally attached to her. It is, you got to put her first. And that's the word that's used here. Because you see, Christ loved us. He put us first. He was willing to go to a cross for us. We talked about that as we had the Lord's Supper, didn't we? We talked about the blood drops falling, you know. He's going to shed that blood for us. He loved us, and because He's loved us, and He gave Himself up as a fragrant offering, a sacrifice to God, because He's done that, we are called to be loving people. Our text today, I think, has been an interesting one. We'll pick up there next Sunday and work our way through a hunk of the rest of this chapter, chapter 5. But I think you'll find it interesting because he's going to end that chapter talking about how folks ought to live in family, how this applies to family. But it's this call to be the people of God. We indeed are to be the people of God. And God has sent His Son to die for us to make life available for us. He's made it indeed available for us. And if you've heard the story of Jesus and this morning you want to confess Him as Lord and be buried in baptism, we'd be happy to share with you that in doing just that. Perhaps there are others who need prayers, and we'd be happy to pray with you. If you need to come, would you come as we stand and sing this closing song?